Thanks, everybody, for joining us this afternoon. Thanks, it's not quite this afternoon. Happy afternoon. For keeping the boat afloat, challenges of sustainable nonprofit publishing. I'm Mary Gannon, the executive director of CLMP, which is the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, which, if you don't know about our organization, we're a service organization that supports independent literary publishers by providing technical assistance, facilitating peer-to-peer learning, and building bridges to connect diverse communities of literary stakeholders. I'm really happy to be here today with three representatives of CLMP member publishers: Jemiah Wilson, executive director and publisher of Feminist Press, which is located in New York City; Erica Goldman, publisher and editorial director of Bellevue Literary Press, also located in New York City; and Chris Fishbach, publisher of Coffee House Press, located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I'm going to get the conversation started and by asking a few questions of our panelists, and then we'll leave some time for Q&A at the end. Hi, welcome. The first question I just wanted to pose to all the panelists is if each of you would introduce your press, touch a little bit on the history, the mission, the kind of books you publish, the number of books you publish a year, who distributes them, your budget range, your staff size. You want to start?
Sure. Hi. I am really proud to represent the Feminist Press. I joined Feminist Press almost 2 years ago now as the first woman of color and the youngest director of the press, and we are going on our 50th anniversary, which will be next year, with our founder turning 90 just a couple of weeks ago. So it's very profound to me to think about the fortitude that it took to keep a Feminist Press going for so long. And we also have Gloria Jacobs in the room, who also is an amazing executive director and publisher of the press, who built a strong foundation for people like me to come after. So we are a press that began to uncover lost works and to correct the canon to ensure that all voices were equally represented. And we started as a global press. We were always a press where we understood that marginalized voices from around the world needed to be uplifted in feminist ways. And I thank Florence, our founder, every day for calling us the feminist press in the beginning, for understanding that feminist ideals are not defined by gender, and really capturing an intersectional model in the very beginning that has persisted and endured, which is why I think we've lasted for as long as we have. We are a staff of 8 people, a small but mighty team. We have 5 interns usually during any season. Our budget's about $1.3 million, and we are distributed by Ingram Consortium. And we do about 15 to 22 books a year, depending on the cycle. We have the 50th anniversary coming up, so we're doing a lot of reissues. So we have kind of had some different upswings in production, different books that we have as well. And we really pride ourselves on telling the stories that are too controversial, too risky for other more mainstream corporate publishers to do, and also uncovering more underground voices and intersectional voices that need to be heard.
Yeah, Chris, that'd be great.
Sure. First, I'm going to give a plug for a Feminist Press book that I recently read.
Thank you.
August, I will be in Paula.
Thank you.
I love it. It's one of my favorite books in the last few years.
It's a beautiful book.
So I run Coffee House Press, and our mission is to create new spaces for audiences and artists to interact, inspiring readers and enriching communities by expanding the definition of what literature is, what it can do, and who it belongs to. It's a pretty new mission statement, and you notice that it doesn't say that we publish books in it. And that for one reason that is that we have to think about the entire field of literature, and we have to think about connecting writers and readers and doing that through different ways that are not just through publishing. We started in 1972 as Toothpaste Press, founded by Alan Kornblum, who I've worked with in a number of years, and who passed away a few years ago. And a number of people in this room knew and worked with Alan. We started as a letterpress enterprise in Iowa and doing broadsides and chapbooks, and then moved to Minneapolis to be the press in residence at the Minnesota Center for Book Arts in the early 1980s. shortly after we became a nonprofit, we became Coffee House Press and started doing trade editions in addition to letterpress work, and then grew along with the kind of general small press movement of the 80s, publishing then fiction and poetry, poetry primarily influenced by Beat New York School, San Francisco Renaissance, and became really known for kind of adventurous fiction and by publishing a great part of our list was by writers of color. We expanded into publishing nonfiction and translation a few years ago, and so now we're up to 18 books a year. Our budget is between 1.2 and 1.4 million. We're also distributed by, I think we're all distributed by Consortium for Income, right? And we have 9 full-time staff members and 9 interns throughout the year.
Great, Erica?
Thanks. I'm the publisher of Bellevue Literary Press, and I also want to make a gesture to Gloria Jacobs, who is the president of our board, the former publisher of Feminist Press. It's wonderful to share an inheritance of Feminist Press inheritance in Gloria. We were founded in the School of Medicine at New York University at Bellevue Hospital after the review was started. The review's first issue was published coincidentally with 9/11, and we came in as a separate project, but also part of the Department of Medicine, with our first list being published in the spring of 2007. The review's mission is to publish work that investigates health, illness, and humanity. And we self-describe as publishing at the intersection of the sciences and the arts, not necessarily medicine, not necessarily the hard sciences, also the social sciences. Basically, when people say, what's that? I sort of squirm away from any kind of satisfactory answer by saying we redefine what that is with every book we publish. We publish books of ideas, literary fiction. While we are interested in ranging those themes and, in fact, really publishing books that investigate what it means to be a human and what consciousness is about, we don't publish, we don't lead with theme. We lead with writing. So writing is an end in itself to us, I think. I had to learn a lot being in the School of Medicine about what these new fields of narrative medicine and the medical humanities are. And I think of, while there's great writing that speaks for itself in the review, I think of it more as applied to, it's writing that is directed toward creating empathy in medical professionals. Whereas I think of us, it's more narrative medicine. I think of us more as medical humanities, with writing as about the human experience as an end in itself. Sort of, it doesn't have to justify itself because it's useful in any way. To me, writing is useful in every way. Good writing is useful for life. So we, this past year, split away from the School of Medicine. And are now an independent 501c3. We're a subtenant in the office suites of Poets and Writers down in the Financial District, and we're thrilled to be in that community because it's very supportive. And we're continuing to do what we've done all along. We publish 8 books a year on average. The list is divided half between narrative nonfiction and fiction, literary fiction. We have now, thanks to a grant from the New York State, we have 2.5 employees, myself included, the half employee. We're thrilled to have, since this is germane to our conversation, a part-time salaried development director for a year. So that's a huge triumph for us. I'm looking forward to the opportunities that's going to open up for us. And we work with 2 substantive outside consultants to handle 1 marketing, publicity, and sales, and the other does our production work. So that's our team, and our budget is hovers around 650,000. Can I cover all the bases?
Yes. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. So all three of you are nonprofit. I wonder how then you define success.
So we have a lot of different ways for doing that. I think it's something I think about a lot with the unique issue of having funders being really driven by impact investment now and the conversations around ROI and return on investment and how you translate books into that, into the minds of people who are looking at that in terms of direct service or some sort of other product of that kind. And for us, it's really about telling a story of how our books are building empathy in qualitative ways, how our books are building movements, talking about some of the quantitative pieces around how many people attend our events, how many people have written about the issues that we've brought into the public conversation, how many interns are going into industry jobs to diversify publishing, because we see us as also an engine for systemically changing the industry. How many partnerships do we have with movement organizations as it relates to book partnerships and programmatic partnerships? How many authors do we springboard into a larger publishing organization or company that then their voices can reach even more people? So we actually look at what can sometimes hurt initially when you'll see an author move on to bigger presses as actually an opportunity to show that the feminist springboard catapult helps them amplify their voices even more because we saw a vision in them. I have a great example of that in Blair Amani, who wrote Modern History for Penguin, and I've also been published by the same imprint she was in, and she has said on many panels that I was the first person who helped her see that it could be a book because I bid on the book after they'd had 17 rejections, and then they got a deal with Penguin. But it took another Black feminist to see that value first. And so, to me, that is a measurement of success. And also, we look at some of the harder numbers around how many universities are course adopting our books, how many people are engaging with our digital content around the books, how many books are we selling. So we're really proud that our book selling revenue is more than half of our budget right now, which is an accomplishment that we're trying to even grow. How many more subscribers do we have to our newsletter? Those sorts of things. And so, and then there's also the publicity indicators as well. And, you know, what kinds of media, what kind of diversified media do we have? And then finally, what kinds of diverse donors are we engaging because they see the transformative impact of our books on culture? And we've seen a lot of that start to happen in the, as a result of the Me Too movement, and how the cover of the I Still Believe Anita Hill book, which Gloria worked on, that was used at rallies, and people were using it as their Facebook imagery and their Instagram imagery, so like book as icon in movement. And that being a measurement of how books can really start other conversations that might not otherwise happen.
Great. Chris?
Well, that was a very excellent and comprehensive answer. So it's like that. Or some of that, as you're doing more than we are. So I think I would add that it's a little more abstractly because it's hard to measure, but I think as a manager, so it's like you're important to think about mission delivery and financial success and the books themselves, but there's also the staff. So as a manager, are we treating our employees right and respectfully? And I know that everyone up here is the same thing, but like that's important, and that also means interns and volunteers that you're treating, and you're, like, it extends beyond that. Like, are you treating the people in the industry that you have? Are you treating everyone respectfully? I think that's the thing about some of our values as an organization. I think that's, it's not enough for us to just publish great books, to work with great writers, but like to be a good literary citizen is another important part of that.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you articulated that point, because we all have to think about ways in which we can be good literary citizens, because we're all in it together, and we'll all go down together if we don't keep each other's backs and pay attention to that. We're at a moment where we have to make a case for the value of literature, period. So that's something that we try to do with every book we publish, and it's an uphill battle at a moment in our culture where people really don't necessarily take the importance of literature for granted. I have learned not to take it for granted because I have to make the case for it all the time, but I used to take it for granted because it's the air I breathe. It's what keeps me going. I measure our success by the incredibly exciting interaction I have with the texts we publish, the writers we publish, and the readers that I'm lucky enough to meet of our work, many of whom have come by our table. Mm-hmm. So quantifying, this is a great challenge for the whole industry, is how do you quantify the impact, ROI, you mentioned. We're not used to quantifying our impact, and I think it's we have to kind of come up with tricks to do that. To me, it's all about the quality of the human life and the human experience. So that's very high-minded and highfalutin, but I have to fall into a book that blows my mind regularly enough so that I can get out of bed and do what I need to do to keep my business going. I just am a proselytizer for the literary arts, and I feel lucky enough to be able to inhabit that space. So I remind myself of that, and I try to nourish my mind and my heart by reading the great books that are published by our colleagues, and realizing, as I started out by saying, that we really are all, everybody in this room is with us, we're all in it together.
I recently read, there's a book called Good to Great in the Social Sector. So that's actually something that's helpful, been helpful to us to think about different ways to measure good to great in the social sector. There's a good to great, which is purely like business, and then they add a supplementary edition, which is about nonprofits and arts organizations, and talks about different ways that you can push your organization through goal setting and also through creating different creative ways to measure so we can show some kind of ROI statistics.
We were in a panel earlier this week it was a meeting for LitNet, which is an organization, an advocacy organization for literary organizations. And there were funders there who were talking about the importance of being able to tell your narrative in a compelling way, and that some, the funders were saying that some leaders, they're not the best at doing that because they're so heads down in the hard work of just trying to make things sustainable. I wonder if you guys could talk just for a minute about how it is that you do that, how you amplify the more ineffable measures of success, like how it is that your books are promoting empathy, things like that.
So one of the things I really am passionate about is using media, taking ownership of media, and kind of taking it back from the small amount of conglomerates that control the conversation. And that has been a part of my feminist activism and mandate coming in, and that's why I really wanted to join the feminist press team at this time in our history, because I would love to do that every day, every single day. You know, I spent a lot of time creating sound bites for feminist pundits before I came on, and so I feel that that's a lot of what I think about at FP. How do we create concise, clear, consistent messages about the work we do that strikes a feeling of impact in people, but also a feeling of empathy and makes people want to join a community? I think so many times in nonprofits, tell me if this sounds familiar, we're always kind of saying, oh, we need your money to survive. Nobody wants to be a part of desperation. People want to be invited to the winning team. And so that's the thing that I really was kind of wanting to talk about with people around, you know, that feeling of saying, even though I know it's scary and we feel like we have to tell people how difficult it is in this landscape where we have the person who's inhabiting the White House and all of these things that we're having to deal with, that we want to talk about why you're winning by being a part of this important literature, by being a part of this community. And so that's about a big part of how we are doing that work, talking about an invitation. Everything we talk about, the grants we're writing, how we are doing social media, it's like, you are invited to join this community. You want to be a part of this crew. This is the crew that is making history, that is like building coalition around these books, or building movements around these books, and you don't want to miss this. You don't want to miss out on that. And people like it. And I think one of the tangible things that we started doing is just doing impact reports. So I had to do that a lot with tech funders in the past. And so we do an infographic at the end of the year that kind of lays out those indicators that I mentioned before of what we do in a sort of creative way and an easy to digest way for people who might be saturated by other kinds of reports to just kind of like get the little tangibles you need. And that's a big part of what we do. We, you know, shout out what we're doing. We shout out our authors. We give people Instagram stories to connect with the empathy. They see our events in real time. When we go places, we are live streaming. We are inviting people wherever they are in the world to be a part of it. We have people seeing our internees with me in the office. They see us in the production room. We want people to be able to really experience what it's like to be a part of the Feminist Press family, and we see that translating into events. And so we're also doing a lot more of inviting donors to participate in our smaller events and participate in the community. Inviting people, when they come to the office, I'll say, hey, if you ever just want to work out of our office and just like use it like a working space, we would love for you to do that just to see what we do. And we've been seeing that that is kind of how you get to the heart of why people support it and making the case for Lit, that they want to be a part of a movement. They want to be a part of an experience.
That's great. You guys want to add anything?
I'd just like to say that I clearly have a lot to learn from you. And that remains to be seen. Finding ways to, again, hook up with each other and share our different perspectives on things, because we're so absorbed by our own efforts and our, you know, we rely on our experience and our perspectives that we bring through, you know, different channels of life. And I don't have your skills. And I'm kind of in awe of them. I'm terrified by them, too, because I don't live in that space that you describe. And I don't know how I could fit that stuff into how I live in the world. So the trick is to figure out how to make associations and affiliations with each other so that we can maintain our individuality and complement each other.
And the people on your team, I just wanted to say that too, that you know there are skills that you have, I'm sure, that I do not have. And some of that also comes from life experience, right? Like I'm aware that there are naivetes, and every year that I learn more that I just don't have because I haven't like been in the game longer, right? And you know, my mom, who had been in ED, used to always say that. She was like, "Girl, you will see this thing that's you know affecting you will not affect you when you're 40." You know, and so there's a lot of that that I have deep humility for, and I think that what I try to do is hire against my weaknesses. And so there are people who really want to get more involved in some of the details that I am just not as good at, who I really fully entrust to do that and to lead and support their leadership inside. And that is a big part of like how I'm managing for that. And I think it can happen the other way, that I have in another organization where I was deputy director, my boss was kind of more of how you described, and I was the person who was out there just like megaphoning all the time, and it worked really well. And so I think sometimes that we don't think about it that way, but I think it's really important, and I'm always thinking about ways I can bring in other people who can kind of help do things that I don't do as well.
Yeah, I think related to that, I was going to talk about team too, is that getting team alignment, getting everyone on the same page so that they can amplify. I was in a lift last night, mm-hmm. and with two of my staff members going back to the hotel after dinner, and the Lyft guy, you know, asked what's going on, and they're like, "Oh, there's writers, I'm sure you all have similar stuff." And he's like, "Well, does anyone even read anymore? Or like, or is it all just e-books?" So we all have to deal with this, happens all the time in different cities. But I just like sat back while my team just like, "No, that's not true. In fact, you know, X, Y, Z, and this and this and that." And I was so proud because I was like, A, I didn't feel like engaging, that I had like four drinks or something. I was like, but they really, like, I was really proud of them. So I actually realized I should tell them that later when I get to the table.
Yeah, that's great. Let's see. I wonder if you guys could talk, shifting gears a little bit, about what has been the biggest financial challenges you've faced over the past 5 years and how you've dealt with them. And it, as we transition into this little part of the conversation, it does strike me, when we're talking about hiring people who have skill sets that we don't necessarily have, I think that that assumes, too, that we have the resources to hire, which is not always the case. But I wonder if you guys could just talk about the financial challenges.
You want to start? So one, like, really good but recent financial challenge that we have is reprinting schedules. Mm-hmm. So there have, as we grow and as we're kind of, starting to deepen the impact-driven way that we're doing things, we're finding that there have been some missed opportunities we had on books that we did not anticipate to sell out when they did, and we had a book that did really well right before the holidays, and we missed a really important window because we felt like we had to kind of, we always kind of try to do the top level of what we think we can do on a book, but we had been too conservative even with that. But at the time, it was also a cash flow issue around what can we reprint, and we're always reprinting backlist titles. And so that has been something that we are really working with our board and, like, just some of the great financial minds. That's a weakness that I have other people helping me with, to see and anticipate, how do we manage cash flow? How do we manage everything else that we need to anticipate? How do we manage potential changes in the landscape and be able to reprint these books as quickly as people need them? And we also want to encourage people to buy from us in-house. So there's this other kind of dynamic we have where Amazon will sometimes say something is not available before it isn't, and then that will, like, get authors upset or other things while we're just trying to fulfill. So I would say the reprinting issue is a big one, and we're trying new and creative ways to be bolder about that, but it's something that kind of keeps me up at night, because I think that it's the kind of thing that we never can 100% know for sure that you're going to get your ROI on, but we want to always kind of lean into it if there's demand.
Yeah, the cash flow thing. I didn't thought about this until when my treasurer was like, the better your books are doing, the less cash you have. Because it's all tied up in inventory, right? And so, and then you don't get it back on all of our schedules for like 5 months, basically. And your printer bills are due months. But so how I was dealing with that, and then we had a really bad cash flow system, like projections. And so, and I realized that I was involved in it on that, so I was like, I need to fix this. And so, like, that was never going to happen because that is too much. So I found someone actually who was really good, like, production person really good at that. So I gave it to her, but I also sat down, and she's working on taking on really well with our content. But I sat down with the entire staff and explained the cash flow and why it was important, and I was sort of saying, okay, because we don't have a good cash flow projections, we need to be out 18, 24 months, possibly, that's fiction. But, like, I want to pay you all more. But I can't do that if I don't have good cash flow projections because I'm too scared and I never want to lay any of you off. Like, I don't want to be surprised by that. But if we know things in the future, when we can take advantage of certain opportunities because of cash, like, that's that motivated, I think motivated them, and they all take ownership of certain parts of their job. Like, it's a motivating factor to help us get really good projections.
Wow, you guys are blowing me away. Cash flow, what's that? To me, it's all about having enough money in the bank so that we can project that we're going to be alive. I promise you I'd be constructive. So we have enough money in the bank to know that we're going to be alive for a certain period of time. So my biggest financial challenge is that the economies of scale don't work. They just simply do not work. The size of our list, the size of our staff, the labor-intensive nature of our business doesn't make sense as a business. So it is fairly typical for nonprofit presses, from what I gather, and you guys may have different, what are they called? I'm losing my words. That's like the great scourge of a word person, right? It's to lose their words, and that's what AWP does.
Yes.
So it's about 50-50, right? Approximately earned versus donated, and donated comes at this point in the history of the planet. Neoliberalism pretty much has prevailed, so donated incomes comes from largely from individuals because the state has. There are wonderful state organizations, the NEA, our own NISA for the state of New York, who really believe in the work that we're all doing, and there's such great supports, but they just don't have enough money. So we have to convince people who've made their money, individual wealthy people who've made their money as capitalists, who think about ROI, to that an investment, it's now investment, it's not philanthropy, it's investment in the literary arts is meaningful, has value. So it's about quantitative versus qualitative. And we have to figure out how to articulate, you know, no matter how much I'm kicking and screaming against the quantitative stuff, we have to figure that out. So thank goodness you're working on it. But honestly, it doesn't, it's bullshit. You know, because you can't quantify what happens to someone's heart and mind when they're blown away by a great work of literary art. So we need to be better, and I'm kind of echoing something that's perennially discussed at AWP in these kinds of sessions. Mm-hmm. We need to learn how to talk the talk, to engage the money. But it's very, we're swimming upstream, because ROI doesn't make sense when it comes to a devalued art market. You know, when you're in the plastic arts and you're in the gallery scene, you can make a ton of money if you bet on the right horse, to mix metaphors. But literature, substantive literature, real literature, I'm not saying that we don't have successes, and there are examples with each of our presses of great economic successes. Fantastic. You know, we all want that. But it's not our mission. We're nonprofits for a reason. So we're trying to amplify and communicate the value of our mission and our quote-unquote product, which is what we now have to call it, literature, the product of literature, so that the money people can get it. So if anybody has any suggestions, I'm taking notes.
Chris, I wonder, in terms of what Erica just said, you could talk a little bit about books in your Books in Action program, and if that at all presents opportunities for you to tell the story of impact in a different way to attract funding, which is not the reason why you're doing it. But.
Yeah. So the idea with Books in Action is another strategy or kind of program of ours where we're not, it's not book publishing, it's not publishing at all, but it's different ways of connecting writers and readers off the page. So the primary one is our CHP and Stacks program, which is we put writers and residents in different libraries, collections, anywhere really. They're there for about 30 hours over a 2 to 3 week period, and they're there to collaborate with that collection to create new work. It's not like you go in residence and work on the novel you're already working on. We don't want that. We want new work inspired by the collection so that it's there to highlight that collection to that library's patrons and to new audiences. Like, hey, look what's here. Like, you know, look what's hiding in this drawer, this awesome stuff. And you can do this too. You can be creative with this work. It's also a way, if we pay the writers to do this, not very much, but it's a reasonable rate. I think it's like $1,200. And they're able to kind of show, it's about giving literature a new relevance in a way, giving writers a new relevance, a way of being in the world. And their audiences see their work in a new way. They see how literature can actually serve a purpose, because we're kind of helping these other organizations. Like, how can we leverage our creative assets to help other organizations, individuals, to achieve their ends? And it's not a moneymaker. So, but it can attract different funding. But the idea being, and this has happened somewhat, is that if we can show enough interest, enough people, like if an uptick in attendance for an organization, like can we then say, okay, organization X, $4,000 or $5,000, we will run this program. We'll put a writer in, we'll bring it in, we'll run this. And if we can show that that's worthwhile, like that's actually a possible business model. Mm-hmm. And
you're also doing a service of an ad for all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's, we've had some public libraries hire us to do this. And so then we do surveys. So this is a real way, like it's even sometimes just like a show of hands, like how many of you now are thinking about different libraries in a different way? Like,
right.
That's like pure, like simple way of getting, like we change people's minds.
Right.
And that's what, so that's one way. And it's like when you are able to be in a room with people, that's not just a meeting, but it's something else. Certain surveys can happen and that kind of thing. And that's, because obviously the biggest challenge is most of our readers, we never have any contact with them. So,
and you can tell that story that literature has, you've partnered with a community organization and that literature has had an impact, etc. Right?
Yeah.
Like the little library project too? I mean, don't you distribute books through?
Yeah, so we distribute basically our overstock and Hertz are given to the Little Free Library organization and they send them out. I don't really know how the postage works for them, but they're basically saying it's size-based. So when they send out the things, it doesn't matter that they're adding 10 books in there with them. So like our book can get distributed through Little Free Libraries. And then wind up wherever.
Right. Does everybody know that program, the Little Free Library program?
Mm-hmm.
How about, do you have anything to add to that, Jemai, in terms of like projects that you do that help you tell the story about impact?
Yeah, so, you know, we've always had programs that we've had out in the community, different events and conferences. For a long time, we had a STEMinism conference that was all about getting young people engaged in STEM, but when I came on, you know, I had always, because my parents were scientists and I was the humanities one, I thought, oh, this has to be STEAM, because I feel like the humanities are so stigmatized, and also that, you know, what does it mean that for some funders to see impact, we have to focus on books on STEM that they would be interested in, not that there's anything wrong with STEM, since STEM, like, fed me throughout my whole life, and until my adult life. And so we did that, and now we are going to be switching that to a more literary sort of workshop for getting more marginalized young people engaged with writing and feminist writing and feminist publishing specifically. And we also have talked about our internship program as an investment for funders to say, hey, we're really trying to change the face of publishing. I'm not the traditional model for what publishing writ large looks like in terms of who is in leadership, and so it's something that's very important to me and also with our team to talk about how we're really intentional about who we hire and how we are trying to create a new pipeline of publishing professionals, and that's something that we're talking to funders about in really intentional ways, as well as talking about how we're doing our book events in accessible ways and being really thoughtful and intentional about making those events more accessible to people with disabilities, communities of color. One example is we just had a hip-hop feminism event that was really, really fun in Brooklyn, and Sophia, who is our development manager, led that event, and it was featuring the Conk Feminist Collection, which was a book that the Conk Feminist Collective did with us. But it was a really, really well-attended event that Melissa Harris Perry showed up at. We were so excited with her small dog. It was very amazing. And we also got protested by RevCom, which was amazing because they all paid to go in, which is a great donation of Feminist Press. Thank you so much. And it gave us more implication of the work that we were doing. And so when we went back to the funder, I said, oh, like, let's tell her exactly what happened, that we created this experience that was emergent and insurgent, and it created discourse that made people uncomfortable. And, you know, people got to see what happens when you mess with black feminists. I don't really recommend it to anyone. We were just like, no, this is our party. Let the DJ play. And it was great. And so I just feel like that kind of event is a part of the programming we offer, that we're engaging the community with these issues. You know, I think they were kind of like begging for me to call law enforcement, and I was like, oh no, I will not invite state violence to this. We won't have discourse, you know? And people got to see what it is that we do. And so we're just really trying to do more of that as the programming piece, to say this, like, feminist press is a community. And even if you disagree with us, like, you can be in conversation with us too. And we also are being intentional about talking about the unapologetic nature of how we don't prescribe feminisms to people. So we've framed that in our grant writing and also in the impact statements we're doing, to say, you know, I mean, there are people who will not get published with feminist press if they are promoting active misogyny or white supremacy, but we are not prescribing a specific feminist mandate or prescription for how people should be feminists. And we are also saying what we're giving you that you might not see in other contexts is like an opportunity to see books in the same season that actively disagree with each other or have different theories of change. And we think that is important, and that is a value that we're providing for culture and for curricula. And so that's another piece of impact that we have.
Great. Do you guys have anything you want to add, or should we open it up to questions? Okay. Anybody have any questions? Because I've got a lot. Yeah.
Hi, my name's David. A couple of years ago, I was asked to be chairman of the board at Omnidon Publishing, and I'm doing a terrible job. You know, my job is to find people of influence and affluence to join the board, and or find ways to prevent the operation and stay out of the operation, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Is there a place for me to go to access best practices, shared successes? Is there a place to go and connect on what does a great infographic for donors look like? Is there a place for me to go and learn about liquidity from a board's perspective around operating? How did you engage with your accountant? Do you pay them? Do they donate their time? Like, where do I find out the answers to the questions that I don't have answers to?
Right.
As we transition from a for-profit to a literary nonprofit, I mean, I advise them that, like, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm not a good choice, but, you know, you learn to say yes to good people.
Right. Sorry, did you say you're a nonprofit?
Yeah, we transitioned from a for-profit to a nonprofit.
Recently, okay.
And I was part of building the board as a part of that transition.
Gotcha.
Now we have a fully operational board, and I still don't know what I'm doing.
Right. Well, I think that there are, I'm trying to remember, do you guys remember the name of the organization? It's nonprofit, I only know it from the acronym, NPCC, I think. And I can follow up with you and send you that resource. But there are sort of network organizations, kind of like CLMP, that serve to provide technical assistance, provide best practices, that kind of stuff for nonprofit administration. So I would start there. I do feel like CLMP has some resources we could offer, so we could connect with you after that. There's also LitNet, that organization that I was talking about earlier, is interested in providing resources for nonprofit administrators, and I think some of the issues that you're talking about are essential and would be the kind of thing that they would want to help address and develop even more resources for. It's an excellent question, because it does feel like a lot of times boards develop kind of organically from small organizations, and they may not have a lot of experience. Do you guys want to talk about anything you could...
I would suggest putting out questions, maybe not all of them at the same time, on the CLMP listserv.
Yes.
Because drawing on the expertise of the community is a great way of getting an array of possible solutions. And I've seen a lot of similar kinds of queries on the listserv, and people do jump in and offer their experience. So I think that we all have a lot to teach each other and to learn from each other.
We can also pair you with like mentor-type people who have experience in the realms that you're looking to gain, you know. Did you want to add anything, Chris?
There's youth funders, institutional funders, actually going to them instead of asking them if they have other resources, or if there are people they fund also. Like, they can probably make connections for you. A lot of, in Minnesota, we have something called Propel for Nonprofits, which was a nonprofit assistance fund. Like, I don't know, it's probably usually state-based or maybe regional, but they have tons of resources and classes and trainings, and even just, like, downloadable financial templates, you know, on there. And so I would, like, just Google, like, nonprofit assistant, nonprofit, whatever, and there's stuff out there.
I have one more question.
Sure, yeah.
I've been on lots of for-profit boards, mm-hmm. which is kind of how I got hauled into being on this nonprofit board.
Yes.
Can you talk me 30 seconds about what the function of the strategic plan is for your nonprofits in relationship to this challenge?
Sure.
Because I'm trying to understand what we're supposed to do.
Right.
Well, we're working on our strategic plan now, and it's something that I really wanted to do coming in and was really excited about doing, because the strategic plan is the map. That is the compass, the GPS, the direction we are going. And I think, for me, I think it protects an ED. Because I love to say, well, you know, it's great that you want to do this one thing, but that doesn't align with this bullet point in the strategic plan. And it helps us all kind of know where we're going and, like, what the agreed community agreements are about what we're doing, so that if anything veers from that, it's put on the bike rack or the parking lot. And so that's what I think it is. And we have an internal strategic plan we're working on with work plans connected to the strategic plan, as well as a more public-facing one, which also speaks to your community, your stakeholders, and your funders about what direction we're going in for the next 3 years.
I want to also just want to comment. I want to thank you for we're all in this together. Like, we're not going to be like, this is a whole other, we got to all figure this out. And we all want to talk about what I don't know, we want to talk about how hard it is to keep the voter vote, but what we found is that what people want to hear is they want to be part of the success plan. Mm-hmm. They want to be part of the winning side, whatever that may be. And so for folks that are built on empathy, we have a hard time kind of getting to an understanding of the point of view of folks that might want to help us. So we're having that challenge.
I would just echo in terms of the strategic plan, you know, usually it's like a 3-year plan, although some people are saying that, you know, you can do it on a year-to-year basis because things change so much. But the whole point in the project is to try to evaluate, do like a competitive analysis or an analysis of the environment, measure your strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and threats, you know, the SWOT thing. But as Jamia said, the whole point is just so that you're all of your literary stakeholders, the staff, the board, and your community is aligned. You're sort of heading in the same direction. You know what you're supposed to be doing, and there are measurable, reasonable goals that you set and that you try to achieve, you know, so that you're working efficiently and you're all on the same page. Just so you know, CLMP has something called, it's basically a grant program where you can apply. CLMP members are eligible to apply for, like, 8 to 10 hours with a consultant, and a lot of our members do come to us and ask for that kind of consultant, like a strategic planning consultant.
Is that an operational ask or a board ask?
It's operational, yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
My name is Hiram. I'm a ED of a small literary nonprofit press in Los Angeles called World Stage Press. Primarily publishes African American literature. My question, I had two questions. One was about, like, because briefly you guys talked about the number of people in your staff, but I'm also interested in learning about, like, essential roles in your staff, you know, and I think that immediately when we think about the notion of a float, at least I think about money, but I feel like there's also other elements of keeping the thing afloat, people and the work that they do. So I wanted to ask you about that. And then also ask you about, one of you talked about a ratio of donated to earned. So I wanted to hear the other ratios as well.
You want to start with staff?
Sure. So we think a lot about capacity. I think as you grow, capacity also becomes a really tough struggle. And I think that what I'm learning is that it kind of never feels like it's enough, because as you have more books or as you have more things you need to manage, you get more revenue. If you get different types of revenue, there's new administrative things that you have to have support. And so we're also trying to think really intentionally about, in strategic planning, do what kinds of things we take on, or you know, with growth, like how do we course correct or make sure that we don't grow too fast in certain ways that we can't be successful with, and be really thoughtful around that. If there's certain opportunities that are put our way that we don't have the structure, infrastructure to support at this time for it to be sustainable. And that is something that I think is really important. For us, our books are selling more now than they had in some past years, and that we're now really excited to be having to raise less from philanthropic dollars as the landscape becomes more competitive, due to the fact that because of what's going on politically, there are a lot of people who are saying, while I think that there's a case for literature being important, I want to focus on reproductive justice or racial justice or Supreme Court work, which is kind of hard to argue against. And, you know, I think that one of the things we think about, too, is how do we communicate more with our readers and the community who really see connection through our books and, you know, see them as a way to fight against alienation or all the social ills that we're fighting for, to have them buy directly from us. And so that's another big part of what we do to help with the capacity piece, to say, you know, when you buy directly from us, you are actually helping us continue to get more capacity to build the infrastructure of this place, and it goes directly right back into producing more of what you get from Feminist Press and from our books. And that is something that's been really helpful. And so we see people who say that, well, in the past, you know, I just kind of, you know, I had Amazon Prime and I just ordered it, which, you know, is fine. But then when they find out how much we actually get if they buy directly from us, and they'll get like a handwritten package from us with stickers and love from the Feminist Press team, that will inspire people to order more from us. And then that money goes directly back into us, bringing in people who can help support the work.
Do you guys want to talk about your staff and how many is on the staff and what the positions are?
Sure. So we have me, publisher. I have a marketing sales manager. I have a publicist. They have an assistant, two of them. I have a managing editor. I have an associate editor, development manager, publisher's assistant, who's also editorial assistant, and then a half-time poetry editor and a half-time accountant. So 9 FTE. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about how the specific responses have to do with capacity. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that you can do if you have the staff to do them, which help you have the staff to do them to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that's a real issue. It goes back to the economies of scale thing that I brought up earlier. And I don't know how many people you have to work with or what capacity you have to bring in people, but I started out in publishing, in mainstream commercial publishing, so I spent a couple of plus decades in a sort of format, a sort of what the industry sees as best practices. There are fewer differences between how Random House and HarperCollins run the process than there are between how Coffee House and Bellevue and Feminist Press run our shops. And there's no one formula. We develop because of a sort of collision of individuals and circumstances. Luck has a lot to do with it, too. So when I started the press, I naturally relied on my personal experience coming out of the mainstream, so I divided different tasks up according to what I knew the mainstream does, and I scaled it down to fit my capacity. So it's hard to answer your question. I mean, the best thing I can suggest is to talk to a lot of different people. And to keep your mind open and to try to, I mean, there are certain basic, you know, we're all in it together. We're all one big community. As far as the whole distribution world, if we want to distribute our books out through traditional bookstores and online booksellers and stuff, we all have to fit into the system. So we have to sort of work backwards and figure out how to accommodate the system in each of us in our own way. So there are certain best practices to follow, and I feel grateful that I learned what that meant in my own context from the mainstream for a good number of years. But I'm really grateful to what I've learned from colleagues in independent, small press, nonprofit, or for-profit publishing, which has taught me that there are many, many, many ways to succeed. And there's no cookie-cutter approach. We can learn from each other. And, you know, that's... There are also, you know, CLMP is a fantastic resource for getting an understanding of best practices and having access to resources to answer specific questions. And the community is generous. So, good luck.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I run Sarah Van Books. Mm-hmm. That's our 25th anniversary. Yay!
It's also my birthday today.
Happy birthday!
Hell of a place to celebrate. Back in the 90s, the late 90s, we got a grant from the Lila Wallace Reader Digest Fund to do an internet project. And one of the advantages of that grant was that we could sit around a table with all the other grantees and talk about the problems that we had. And what came up over and over and over again was getting your board to do any work. And I hear, here it is 25 years, and I'm still struggling with this. So I would love to hear any advice. I mean, I've got 10 board members, but I'd say maybe one or two of them actually do any work. And by that I mean signing letters and going to large funders and all of that. So that's my question.
Okay. Who wants to take it?
I have thoughts about that. What I would say is I am somebody who is, like, really interested in nonprofit governance. And, you know, have worked in different nonprofits and tech ones and that sort of thing. And so when I came in, and I think it was kind of annoying to some people because they wanted to talk about the literary stuff, but I was like, oh, let's talk structure and governance, like board development orientation. And, you know, if we want to get a higher guide star rating, the board has to self-evaluate itself and all those kinds of things. And, you know, when I look now at, like, where the board was 2 years ago and then, like, some of the shifts that have happened, sometimes people will self-select around their willingness to want to be a part of that party.
Right.
Because that inherently means that when you impose, like, a different, like, I'm trying to think of, like, a non-militaristic term around, like, how you, like the gridiron lines around, like, the structure and governance piece. But I observed this from other EDs that I watched, like, mentors I had. And my mom was like this in her work, that she would kind of be like, yeah, you know, if they roll you out for doing that, then, like, God bless them. You'll do on your next thing. But it will be to your peril as an ED if you don't just, like, make all the structures and governances infrastructurally, like, be in protection of the mission at all times. And what happens is if there's people who might be motivated not by mission stuff, then it just, like, kind of makes them say, well, I just don't want to play, because you actually actively have to come to strategic planning committee meetings. You actively have to vote on things. You actively have to follow bylaws. You actively have to engage in, like, systems of accountability. And so I often think about, like, how do you promote a culture of accountability versus one of power? As it relates to, like, any board that I sit on, and, like, the boards that, you know, govern our work. And what I would say is, like, this is a great time to invite people to be like, oh, we should really look at our, like, organizational development and board development structure and, you know, maybe, like, have a 4 times a year orientation and, like, several meetings and all of that kind of thing. And I swear to you, it will help you to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Do you guys want to add anything?
I had breakfast with someone this morning who was talking about this a little bit, and they said that they'd done the thing where they, for each program that they have, they created, like, a advisory council sort of thing, where it was made up of a board member, a staff member, and then a couple people from, like, the outside, he said, to kind of give it air.
And at every single board meeting, the board member needed to report on that advisory council. Mm-hmm. And so, and the first time it happened, it was a total mess, because he said it was all like really type A personality people who were really like successful in their careers and stuff. And then like they're caught off guard at the first meeting, and they don't, and then they never want to get caught off guard again. And so like, but it really was like they had to talk to the staff and say like, how should we report on this? And then that he said was really helpful. I just learned about this morning, but I'm happy to go past that. I'm not really good at it. Have not had a lot of success. It's just some board members yes, some board members no. Sometimes there's a board member who came to one meeting in 9 years, but it was okay because he would meet with me quarterly for lunch. Like, he's a business like genius guy, and I could just sit down and come up with these things, and I just learned so much over that one period.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and so like it's, and I kept telling the board members like, no, it's fine. I want him involved. Like, he's a good donor and he serves this great, great purpose. Like, don't kick him off. He also was like worked at Target, which is a big funder for us. But
I mean, I would add to that, you know, CLMP is a nonprofit as well, and you know, I think it's, I agree with Jemiah that putting into place strategies for accountability is really important. You know, we have board terms. The board has to agree, we have a letter of commitment that the board needs to sign every, you do too.
Yeah, he doesn't follow it.
Yeah, well then I think that it's really important to create opportunities, and like even that, where it's an advisory council and they have to report, if they don't do it, then you have to have a conversation about the fact that maybe it's time for them to move along, or they need to engage, you know. I think it's not the easiest thing to do, but it's really, really important, because as a nonprofit, you need that support. And the board is the owner of the brand. They're supposed to be the sort of closest stakeholders to the project. And so if they're not doing that, that's a problem, you know.
I have a question, if I may ask it.
Yeah.
Do you have an executive committee on your board?
What?
An executive committee?
No.
Because what I think, like, look at your bylaws, or because it might be a great opportunity to revisit the bylaws, and, you know, have a lawyer kind of help you with that, or if you have a lawyer on your board who wants to champion it. What I discovered in our bylaws was that there are certain things that I think people just thought writ large had to be voted on by the board as an entire entity of over 20 people, but that in fact in the board bylaws, they only had to be voted on by the executive committee. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you know, the treasurer, the vice president, president.
Sure.
And so in doing that, there's a lot more efficiency about things that could be done. And then when you have people who are in those roles inherently have deliverables that, you know, kind of are needed and embedded in the structure of accountability and you know, what happens if those things aren't happening. So I would say that maybe forming an executive committee would be what I would do if I was in your position for the first kind of move, and then having them revisit the bylaws and then voting on upgrading those bylaws so that there are points of accountability around what happens if those things aren't moving.
Mm-hmm. Right. And your 25th anniversary is a good opportunity to do that, too.
Yes, I know. We still have most of the year to do this. One thing that we have developed recently is a young professionals board. Mm-hmm. So the dues are greatly reduced, but we have lots of young people in the community coming in who are very eager to be part of Saraband, and I think that's going to work well for the future. Eventually, you know, in the next 10 years, they're going to be the board members, hopefully.
Right.
Who knows?
That's really smart that you're thinking about it now.
Yeah.
I'd say that when Alan invited me to start being involved with the board, we did not really have committees. We had executive committee, and that was it, basically. But one thing I did first was brought on two people I'd worked with on other boards who were total governance wonks. And so they like want to have these structures. They like love at putting everything in order. And they came in and created a committee structure and updated bylaws, calendars, and everything. They weren't, in fact, they were small givers. They did not have capacity. But like what they brought was really valuable. And so
okay,
that was really helpful.
Great.
Any other questions? Yeah,
I'm interested in learning more about the alternate revenue streams that you mentioned and kind of the community building that you do in the world around events, that where the books are a support to those, to that community building, rather than the reverse, which is what I think most traditional publishing looks at publicity events for.
I think a big part of Feminist Press's mission started out as an educational nonprofit, so it was about amplifying feminist perspectives, and so we think about that in every event that we do. So we now have a benefit that's coming up in June that we started because my partner happens to be a jazz musician, and I observed that there's so many similar gender disparity issues in jazz that you see in publishing and in media as well, that why don't we kind of create a collective within the arts to address these issues. And so now we do a Jazz for Gender Justice benefit every year. And so what we do is kind of throw a jazz party and have bands play. We're like, you know, some of the cis men, like my husband, play supporting roles and as like side people in the bands, but these are like, you know, women fronted, like non-binary fronted bands play instrumentalists. You know, we had a great Barry sax player last year, Lauren Sevian. That's not an instrument that's usually played by women, who was a headliner for us. And we also had books there that were kind of related to some of the communities that they represented. So we have an amazing Iranian artist, Rena Farhan, who's been banned from Iran because her music has been part of the Green Movement and other democracy movements, and then we had some of our books by Persian authors there at the event. And so that year we did it with Joe's Pub the first year, and this year we're doing it with Lower East Side Girls Club and using their space to also collaborate and to bring people into their space and to see what they're doing to help them as well, and also invest in them by investing our money in their space, but as well as amplifying the solidarity that we have as creators of art in gender. And so that's just one example. And so what I kind of learned from doing this experience was also kind of that we each have strengths or connections to communities that we might not necessarily think would be the communities that could help us build the work we're doing. And I just happen to know a lot of people who would say, oh, well, I love you and I love this mission, so I'll play for a very, very reduced rate, very, very, very reduced, to come and be a part of your benefit. And then they, using their social media and their platforms, are also introducing other people to us and our books. We had the Resistance Revival Chorus from the Women's March perform last year, and so that got a lot of other people who were engaged, and it was kind of a mutual beneficial thing. So that's kind of example. What I would invite you to do is think about, you know, what do you have access to? I mean, I've been long thinking about how Sophia on my team's done roller derby, and I'm like, how do we do a roller derby event? Because I know that roller derby people are really intense about roller derby, so I'm trying to figure out how we connect, like, the books to that. And just, like, who in your community or what, like, who are the people who love you and would want to build with you, and you can also help them out to kind of create the intentional programming.
Does anyone have anything? Any other questions?
Yes.
Oh, time.
Just the time. There's time for one more question.
Anybody have a question?
This might be a little bit, I mean, sorry, this is not the a great last question. For you guys, how do you navigate? I mean, we're an arts education organization, mm-hmm. and we publish the students that we write with. Mm-hmm. One of the big things that we face, just beyond, nobody wants a book by elementary school students, but beyond that, one of the big things that we face is that for arts organizations, we're not included in any of them. The literary arts isn't included. We get stuck in English language arts, we get right. stuck in, you know, this stream of things, especially in the K-12 world, mm-hmm. right? And so how do you guys address, I'm interested to know, I don't know if it's an issue for nonprofit literary classes, it isn't a huge issue for us that we're sort of in this arts space, and however, we're not really, we're like the afterthought, mm-hmm. or often not included, especially when it comes to funding, to events, to community things. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if you guys have ever dealt with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say my answer to that, because it was tricky, there were people I'd worked with in other organizations I'd been a part of, and I kept thinking, what's the disconnect between this funder and what we're doing now? Because it's so similar. It's about platform building and changing the discourse and representation and systems change and paradigm shift, and you fund that here, and why is this not connecting for you? And then I realized that sometimes there was a funder that I worked with for many years that said that they had a mandate in their strategic priorities that they don't fund publishing. And so what I did was I thought, but, you know, you have fellows, because I have been a fellow in that program, you have fellows who are self-publishing books when I could help them connect with a publishing company that would give even more reach to their message and also intentionally help them shape it. What if, and I had alumni money for my fellowship, so I said, I'll donate my alumni money back if you give us a grant with their alumni money, and I'll show you how publishing creates change. And I'll invest it back into the other organization. And what that lesson was, and I really believe in this person and the work that they're doing, but that helped them see that there was this compelling reason to rethink about how publishing could be a vehicle for supporting something else. But what had to happen was to create a partnership with an organization that they saw more clearly fitting into the strategic priorities. And so the partnership model, I think, and not in a transactional way, like I'm saying this, like it has to be transformational to work, not about using people in any way, but to say, you know, what are the other organizations that you see might be getting some of the support, but could use what you're bringing to also help them get a level up, and talk about writing joint grants together. And then that will also help these organizations see you in a different way. And we've seen this, even with some people who haven't yet given us the money yet, they do not get it yet, saying they're starting to get it more, which I think is also a win.
Great. I want to thank everybody for coming, and thank you to our panelists. It's been great.